You're listening to an encore presentation of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Gosh, I can't believe it's been almost a month since I saw Dr. Thomas Williams and Liz Lev, his beautiful wife, in person at the wonderful event that Liz did for the patrons at Corporate Travel. It was fantastic. It was a sellout. She did a really neat presentation, a different one, all about the Grand Tour, which was fabulous. Sorry, I know I brag on your wife all the time, but I brag on you, too. You're a wonderful theologian, author, writer, and speaker. Thomas, you know, as being an American, that we're struggling here in the United States, and Catholics are really, we know that we are called to serve the most vulnerable, and we have a heart for the immigrants, for migrants, but I think there's a lot of confusion. We have a man who calls himself a Catholic in the White House, but the situation, as I'm sure you've been monitoring with the writing that you do for Breitbart and other different outlets, the situation has gotten to a crisis situation. Folks on both sides of the political aisle are admitting this now. And I think there is, though, a misunderstanding that could be put forth by some in church leadership that we have to do every single thing and there are no limits on what a country should be doing for immigrants. So what does a church, let's start out with that. I know you have some other articles you want to discuss. What does the church actually teach us about this situation? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Teresa. And this is such a great question because, I mean, everybody knows that we have need for immigration reform in the United States. We know that there are, you know, that the situation is not well under control. So that's kind of common ground. But the church actually has very clear teaching on this. The church, while, you know, always preaching welcome the stranger, to be open-hearted with people who are different than we are, because the stranger is not just the migrant, the stranger is anybody who is not of our clan, if you will. So there's that openness and that welcoming spirit, but that doesn't always translate directly into public policy. And the church has never, ever said that it does. Not even Pope Francis, who, as you know, is a big advocate of a very welcoming, even on the level of national bodies. But he has never said that there's anything like an obligation to open your borders or to welcome all migrants. In fact, what he said is nations should look at their situation and determine how many and at what pace they can come in, making sure that they can be assimilated as they come. So it's not just, you know, forming small ghettos here and there, as we've seen in Europe. That's a huge problem. We have especially Muslim ghettos here in Italy. Now in France, France is rife with these, and they form little subcultures within the culture. But what the church actually teaches on this is that every nation, every sovereign nation, has the right to control its borders and to determine who comes in. Right? They're allowed. They're allowed to vet them. They're allowed to determine why they're coming in, whether, and they don't have any strict obligation to allow any particular person to cross that border. So that's the first thing. The church teaches, again, to, in the degree that it's possible, to be welcoming, especially for those who are fleeing dangerous situations. And here, too, there's a distinction that we make between economic migrants, those who are trying to better their situation, and true refugees, those who are fleeing a situation where their very lives are in danger. And that's a distinction that's very, very important for us as Catholics.
So what is your take on what's happening right now at our border, watching the situation from a Catholic teaching perspective? Thomas, what do you think?
Well, I think what we really need is more regulation, in the sense that things need to be better ordered, better controlled. The worst thing that can happen is chaos. The worst thing that can happen is one of these panic situations. You cannot just open a gate and a floodgate and let people just come streaming through. You can't do that. The best thing you can do, honestly, is to start people on the process while they're still on the other side of the border. This is something that, you know, we've asked for, the United States has asked for in the past, where people start the process so you can start getting a sense of who they are, why they want to come in, what they want to do. Because right now, as you know, and we've got an atrocious problem with illegal immigration. We've got so many illegal migrants, and the question of what do we do? Just grant, you know, grant amnesty, you know, en masse to all of them, or do you send them all back out? Do you deport them? I mean, there's no good solution to a situation that for years has been building up because we've had very porous borders. Porous borders don't give rights to those who cross because they're always illegal, they're always hiding. and it makes them vulnerable and subject to abuse both by employers and by landlords and other people. It's not good for them, and it's not good for the country. Porous borders, you know, whatever you thought of or think of, the idea of a wall, you know, wall is an imposing thing, and a lot of people just don't like the symbolism of it. But the fact of maintaining a border where you have a door, and people, if they want to come in, have to knock at the door, and they have to be admitted, because they're coming into a sovereign nation as if you're going to somebody's house, that's a very good thing. It allows you to do things in a hospitable mm-hmm. way, in an ordered way, in a regulated way, and not this chaotic situation like we have right now at the border.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Williams, author, speaker, theologian, and professor, living and teaching and working in Rome. Written a number of recent articles. He writes regularly for Breitbart and other outlets, a number of great articles, and we'll put a link to all of them, the most recent ones, on the Catholic Connection archive. One of the things I think that is really just shocking to us is all of a sudden, in the last 2 weeks, we've seen the situation develop with the Haitian migrants at the border and the international bridge, where at one point we had up to 15,000. And then we come to find out just recently that although they are from Haiti, they have been living already in central and southern parts of South America and Central America, and that many of their ID cards have been left behind. They've been trying to get themselves established. So it's not as if they're coming directly from Haiti and victims from the hurricane or some of the other problems they've had there. And they've been making their way, and we're told now that there's another 20,000 that are going to try to come through. This just seems to me like we're not being told, we're not given the straight information by this administration. These people have been working their way into the United States for a long time.
Well, again, and these are, you know, a lot of the ones you're talking about right now who are not fleeing the immediate situation in Haiti, but they are just trying to improve their lot in life. That's understandable. That's something that is a good thing. But a receiving nation has the right to know who's coming in, what their background is, what their intentions are. These are things that we should find out. Otherwise, you put your own citizens at risk if you just allow people to come in without knowing who they are and what they're doing. And these right now, as you say, constitute more economic migrants, in the sense people who are looking for a better life. And again, that's to be applauded. That's a good thing. But you can't just open up to that. We had a situation like that here in Europe. I think it can be illuminating for the United States. Just 5 years ago, we had a situation of over a million African migrants coming in, and of course they would love to come and get all the social benefits, and the life is much better economically speaking, materially speaking, in Europe than it is in almost any country in Africa. And so it's very enticing. But you can't just open that up and say, come on in, everybody, because there are not jobs for these people. We've got enough unemployment among the citizens already. I mean, there are so many factors that need to be looked at in order to do this in a careful, ordered way.
So then what is our Catholic response, Thomas? Because this is a question we always struggle with, is we want to always be open to the most vulnerable. We're pro-life from womb to tomb. How do we respond to this? By being concerned, by seeing Jesus in all of these people, as we're called to see in all of our brothers and sisters, regardless of their state in life. How are we to respond? Because it's overwhelming. I mean, if you talk to, and we've got now both people on both sides of the political aisle, Democrats and Republicans, speaking out. Governor's very upset about what's going on. There's a new letter that was just penned by Governor sent to the Biden administration, demanding that they listen to him about the situation they're seeing there across the border in the south part of our country. What do we do as Catholics? How do we respond to this, do you think?
I mean, as Catholics, it's interesting because we have positions. We are pro-migration in general. The right to migrate is a right. It's very interesting. The Catholic Church does not talk about a right to immigrate, but to emigrate. You can leave. No one has to accept you. Somebody once compared it, a fellow theologian friend of mine said, it's kind of like the right to marriage. You have the right to look for a wife, but no woman has the obligation to accept you. You have to convince her that you're the guy for her. And it's kind of like that. You have a right to emigrate. You have a right to look for a country to accept you, but no country has a strict obligation to take you in. That's the first thing. Secondly, we looked at the balance. You know, another principle of Catholic theology is the right to national security. And part of national security is, again, knowing who comes and goes and making sure your borders are secure. So we have many different principles that need to all be harmonized together in an ordered way. And I think that's what it is. We're not black or white. You know, it's just all immigration all the time. We are in favor of this ability of people to move, but we want it to be done in a very careful, ordered way. And that cannot be just by, you know, crashing the borders, which ends up looking more like an invasion than peaceful migration. And that's, I know that rhetoric sounds very harsh, but it sometimes looks like that. And we have to avoid that at all costs.
Are you optimistic at all, being an American and watching this situation closely and knowing what you've experienced living in Rome for so many years? And I can remember exactly what you're talking about when we would go to visit and we saw the results of that situation that you described. Are you optimistic at all? You follow politics very, very closely here in terms of the way this administration is reacting.
I mean, I confess that I don't have huge hopes for this administration's ability to sort out most things. I've not been awfully impressed in this, you know, first year of Mr. Biden's administration. But I know that there's a lot of pressure on him, and that might force him to do the right thing. I think that this is a question where they're going to want to get a little bit of bipartisanship going, look for good solutions that people can get behind. I don't know whether that's going to happen. He really has not shown a lot of openness to that kind of dialogue, because at the moment the Democrats hold both houses, and that makes it, you know, gives you a position of power where you don't want to dialogue. But he might be brought to that by the fact that, you know, everybody is now appalled at this situation. This isn't coming exclusively from conservatives. This is liberals as well who are saying
right.
This is unsustainable.
Right, and his approval numbers are way, way down again, dropping another 6 points. And think about this, Thomas, you and I know media, both work in the media, and you work as a, you know, media consultant, and you've been on air many, many times, so you know how things operate. And the media have been in his corner for the most part, with the exception of maybe one or two outlets and a few of the outlets online. But he has a mass media behind him, and his numbers continue to drop. What does that tell you?
I mean, it's just when it becomes so overwhelming that you can't deny the obvious, I think people are getting upset, you know. And
yeah.
You're right. I mean, he has had the media are 100% in his corner, but you know, you can't dissemble forever. And if there's a situation that's really serious, you have to show it.
Yeah. Well, there's so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, but being that this is the lead story here and really pressing on so many of us in terms of from a Catholic perspective and how we can be both Christ-like and be true to our faith, but also, you know, have a true understanding of the teachings. I really appreciate your input as a theologian. I do want to remind people that he has a number of articles, Dr. Williams, very, very excellent articles. Pope Francis calls on Europe to remember its Christian roots. He also wrote recently, as recently as September 21st, 2 days ago, on the situation with the Mexican Supreme Court and abortion, and also on situations developing in Nigeria with Christians there that were killed by suspected Muslim raiders. So a lot of things that you've been following, Thomas. Thanks for your expertise. Have to have you back on very, 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 very soon, because there's a whole ton of articles we didn't get to this morning. I wish we had a four-hour show. Dr. Thomas Williams, give us your website if folks want more information.
It's www.thomasdwilliams.com. And thank you, Teresa. It's such a joy to be with you.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio.
Welcome back, Catholic Connection. Always trying to provide you with great tools to make a difference and help spread the gospel. On the phone with us is a dear friend of mine. Her husband, Deacon Mike, was ordained in the same class as my husband, Deacon Dominic. And so we had a very blessed class and are very close. And she does a great job of evangelization. She works for the Archdiocese of Detroit. She's an author. She's a speaker. And she is committed to evangelization. And I can attest to that personally, because I know her work. And she does a great job, especially now with continuing to promote this beautiful program called 52 Sundays, which they are marketing nationally now. Anita, thanks for joining us. Anita Houghton is our guest.
Thanks, Teresa. It's good to be here.
Good to be here. Okay, so what's the latest with 52 Sundays? I know that this is a program that's been with the Archdiocese for a little while, but now you're taking it further, correct?
Absolutely. So this is our third year that we are publishing 52 Sundays. And for those listeners who are not familiar with what it is a book aimed at families to help them reclaim Sunday, the Lord's Day, with prayer, activities, food, and more. So it has every Sunday, so it's a calendar year tool, begins with the first Sunday of the year, of the calendar year. It prints the gospel, and it gives reflection questions and a saint of the week to reflect on, an activity to do together as a family, a family prayer, a recipe, a liturgy link to look for something specific at Mass that week, a family challenge to how to live the gospel, not just on Sunday, but throughout the week. So this resource was developed in answer to our Archbishop's pastoral letter, Unleash the Gospel, to mm-hmm. put families at the heart of our evangelization efforts, to help them, to equip them, to become, you know, parents to become spiritual guides of their children. So this is our third edition, and we've marketed it in primarily in the Archdiocese of Detroit, though the news spread and it spilled out to other dioceses across the country. But this year we're making a full effort to market it nationally so that we can get this resource into the hands of every Catholic family in the United States.
And what I think is so great about this is because oftentimes, okay, even if the parents are doing, you know, whatever they can to get the family, the kids to Mass every week, it's like, okay, what do we do afterward? How do we apply it at home in addition to just talking about it with our children? These are real concrete ways of doing this, correct?
They are. And what we're finding is as we talk with parents and receive their feedback is that a lot of them have a desire to do something more, but they don't know what to do. And so we give those tools to give them ideas, and they don't have to do every little thing that's in each week's spread, but they can pick and choose what they want to do. And the two things, you know, besides the reflection questions, which help to foster conversation about the gospel message, whether at breakfast, you know, at before or after Mass or what have you, there are just fun things to do. We want families to spend time together. So just the activities aren't necessarily religious activities. They're fun
right.
activities. We want families just simply to have the ministry of presence for parents to be present to the children and vice versa. And especially during the pandemic, this book was just invaluable because our Sunday Mass experience had changed substantially. And so parents could use this book at home to help them to celebrate Sunday in a different way.
And you have a Spanish version of this, correct?
Yes. So this year we are printing a Spanish edition. So 52 Sundays also has an online version. You could go to 52sundays.com and sign up to get the weekly spread to your email. But the book is kind of nice to have because you get the recipes and you know you can show it to your children. It has illustrations and what have you. But this year we wanted to make sure that we were ministering to our Hispanic brothers and sisters, so we were printing the whole book in Spanish. So you can buy the book in English, you can buy the book in Spanish, you can sign up online to get the 52 Sundays in English or Spanish. And if you wanted to, you know, take a sneak peek at it, you can go to 52sundays.com to see what this year's content looks like, but you can also go to LPI.com /52-Sundays to take advantage of our special pre-order pricing, which gives some discounts.
What are you hoping as someone who's worked in evangelization for many years, and also as someone who's, you've been out there in terms of not just with the Archdiocese, but you worked at the parish level and you've done so many presentations and you've done work as an associate professor at Sacred Heart Major Seminary. What do you think is most needed right now, given our post-COVID world? Anita, what do you think?
I just think just to pause and to stop and just kind of pause and think about the bigger questions in life. Mm. You know, what is this all about? Who am I? And who is God? And what is it? What is my purpose? And I just think maybe even tuning out some of the social media and the tension that is just out there in our country today, just to maybe just do some soul searching and just really reflect on the beauty of life, the gifts of God, and to really kind of step into what God is calling us to be as persons and the roles that we have as fathers, as mothers, as husbands and wives. I think there's just so much comfort and solace in that, that it helps to put all of life into perspective, and then just brings the treasury of our Catholic faith alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then when we pause and begin to just enter into the beauty of the liturgical year, to really listen to the prayers at Mass, to listen what the readings are speaking to us personally week after week, it's a way to really live, you know, as a joyful missionary disciple. And the 52 Sundays is just a tool to help get at the core of that.
Yeah, I think it brings everything together. I really do, because sometimes we tend to compartmentalize things and say, okay, now we're at Mass, and then we come home and now it's separate. But if we're living a truly Catholic life 24/7, then everything, you know, we look at everything, as we say at Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, through the lens of Scripture and the teachings of the Church. So everything is part of who we are as a Catholic.
Yeah, it's so true. My husband uses this analogy of, you know, oil and vinegar. If you shake that up to dress your salad, you know, if you don't shake it up, it remains separate. We don't want our faith to be like the sediment at the bottom. We want it to be integrated with our lives. And I think, you know, I think that programs like 52 Sundays and another example is Father Mike Schmidt's Bible in a Year.
Oh, yeah.
So it's engaging people on a massive level. This is what we want with 52 Sundays. We want this to be a movement. We want it to really enter into people's homes. And then and God does something with that. It's not the book itself, though I think the book is great. I'm biased because, you know, my team at the Archdiocese put it together. But I think there's something of God in this, right? The Holy Spirit is going to act. It opens the door for a conversation, for a thought, for a pondering. And the other great thing is each year we have like a theme with 52 Sundays. This year is vocations. So we have woven into the discussions, the prayers, the saints. How is God calling you to live?
Amen.
You know, what
Amen.
Is your vocation? And all vocations, the priesthood, the religious life for sure, the married life for sure. But, you know, if God is calling you to a particular profession, like being a doctor or a teacher or a professor, how is that going to glorify God?
And the saints, Anita, we're out of time. Let me give the website, 52sundays.com, and we'll have it posted on our archive section. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamia.
Welcome back, Catholic Connection. I wanted to draw your attention to a story. Excellent story on the Catholic News Agency website, catholicnewsagency.com. I just posted this on my Facebook page this morning. Katie Yoder from Catholic News Agency did a great job on summarizing the brief that was filed in response to another brief filed by some 500 female athletes claiming that women need abortion to succeed. So in response to that, law professors Teresa Collette, Helen Alvery, and legal scholar Erica Bacciacci filed an amicus brief representing 240 women scholars and professionals and various pro-life organizations in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which the Supreme Court, of course, we know will hear that case on December 1st. The case challenges Roe v. Wade, the 1973 case that legalized abortion nationwide, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which upheld Roe again in 1992. Which is so great about this is that in the brief, and if you're not familiar with these law professors, they're phenomenal. Helen Alvery has been on the front lines of these issues for decades. She's just an incredible witness to the faith. In their brief, the women point to evidence that counters a narrative that women need abortion to succeed and achieve equality with men. More specifically, the brief takes issue with Casey's argument that the ability of women to take part equally in the economic and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to, quote-unquote, control their reproductive lives. Don't you love the wording there? By the ability to control their reproductive lives, also known as the ability to kill their own children. How is it that we've gotten so far in this world, gone way too far in thinking that women have to attack their own flesh and blood in order to get ahead? And we saw over the weekend so many sad examples of this with these actresses that are just so revered and on all the fashion magazines, the Jennifer Anistons and the Jennifer Lawrences. Andrew sent me one story of Jennifer Lawrence holding up a pro-abortion sign above her baby bump. She's pregnant. Jennifer Aniston saying men can't comment on this because they can't have children. Well, wait a minute. What does that say about Hollywood pushing the whole transgender agenda? I know that's a whole other topic, but last time I checked, it also still takes a man and a woman to have a child. So they want more respect from men, but then they push men out of the whole situation when men want to be involved And we know this through, of course, Silent No More, where more and more men are actually speaking up about how abortion affected them. In the athlete's brief, three times, according to the CNA report, three-time Olympic swimming medalist Chrissy Pernham shares her story about undergoing an abortion prior to an important race early in her college career. I was on a scholarship, I was just starting to succeed, and I didn't want to take a year off. I wasn't ready to be a mom. However, in their brief, the women scholars cite data and research refutes the idea that abortion is both responsible and critical for women's progress in society. Among their arguments, number one, women were making progress long before Roe. As evidence, they point to Jeanette Rankin, the first woman elected to Congress, a Republican from Montana. She was elected in 1916, 4 years before the 19th Amendment secured women the right to vote. Following the amendment, a number of women entered political office at the highest levels, who became senators, congresswomen, and governors, according to the brief. Women also enjoy protections in the law before Roe. These include the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, which established a minimum wage regardless of sex. The Supreme Court in 1947 in the case Fay versus New York also appreciated that women were equally qualified to serve on juries. This brief, presented by the pro-life women, presents a long list of federal legislation in the 60s and 70s, again prior to Roe, which was 1973, that promoted women's equality, including the Equal Pay Act of 1963, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, the Public Works and Economic Development Act of 1977, the Equal Employment Act of 1972, which called for equal access to jobs for those with similar qualifications. The brief also references a number of state constitutional provisions, statutes, and cases protecting women against discrimination that went into effect around the same time. This is crucial information that so many people do not know, have no idea is available and has happened in this country's history prior to Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, because the media are not covering this. How much coverage outside of the Catholic News Agency did this brief, filed by Helen Alvery and the other experts on the pro-life side of this argument, get? I didn't see anything except here on, maybe I'm missing it, but I'm on these different websites every day. They also showed in their brief that there's no consistent correlation between abortion and women's socioeconomic success. The women scholars acknowledge that women made progress immediately after Roe, as abortion rates and ratios rose, but they also emphasize that progress began decades before Roe and continued when abortion rates and the ratios were falling at a dramatic pace. Between 1990 and 2016, the scholars say abortion rates declined 46%, abortion ratios fell 52%, but women in their progress didn't slow down. Their progress at the same time actually continued to accelerate. The percentage of women in the workforce with a college degree or more rose from 24.5% to 41.6%, the brief states. Women also earned an increasingly percentage of men's income. Women-owned businesses skyrocketed. According to the Census Bureau's economic census, 5.4 million women owned businesses existed in 1997. 20 years later, in 2017, women owned 11.1 million businesses, according to the National Association of Women Business Owners. So these are the facts, brothers and sisters. To sit there and say that women can't be successful without the legal rights to kill their own children, not to mention damage themselves emotionally and physically, and what abortion does to the rest of the country and the world and each and every one of us when a life is lost, as a pope has reminded us over and over again, it's like hiring a hitman to solve a problem. But this is information that people do not know. And with this case coming up before the Supreme Court that could have a huge impact on Roe v. Wade, we need to lovingly have the information to share and to get people to think. Get people to think and ask them questions. Are you aware of this? Are you aware of this? Do you know about the success that women had before abortion? And why do you think it's okay to put women in that position, that they have to kill their own children and put themselves at risk emotionally and physically in order to get ahead? And whatever happened to the fact that when the whole women's movement started, that they said women could be able to choose to have a family and work. They should be open to both. The world should allow them that. Don't they see how this is discriminating against them? When they claim they want the opportunity for all these choices, and then they're forced, they say, to make a very, very difficult choice, and they admit that this is a horrible choice to make, most of them, at the end of the day. We need to point this out, and this article is a great summary of what's happening and the brief that responds to these very false and misleading claims. Check it out, CatholicNewsAgency.com. I've also posted it on my website. We have got to get the truth out there, and this article is excellent, filled with all kinds of facts that can make a difference. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamia.
So excited to get Terry Polakovic on the phone with me. She and I have known each other for years. We've worked together. We've attended conferences together. We've spoken at conferences together. And she has just a great background in teaching the truth in love, former director of Endow, educating on the nature and dignity of women. Just an amazing apostolate that is still going strong, helping us understand the beauty of church teaching on women and more about the saints and so much more about all the teachings of the church. And this book, Women of Hope, is about the doctors of the church. The doctors of the church is actually the subtitle. So, Terry, I have to tell you a godsend I had on the way down. I was speaking to the Goddess chapter in New Orleans last week, and I had your book with me. And I had just started it. Well, I hadn't started it. I brought it with me, and that was my goal, to read it on the plane there and back. And I finished it very, very quickly because it's just one of those books you can't put down. But so I'm looking at my notes as I'm going down to this talk, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I forgot a couple of scripture verses, because I always like to start out my talks, and this was on my new book, Listening for God, about hope and recalling what God has done, that we need to recall the times in our life when God has been so true to us despite the situation, whether it be in the world, in the church, in our own lives. And so I made a note on my papers to, when I get to the hotel, to look up the various verses, a few verses I wanted to begin the talk with. And so then I grab your book, and where I'm going with this, right? And so I open to your introduction on page 11. Now, I'm thinking about remembering. I'm thinking about hope. I'm thinking about encouragement, right? And I hadn't cracked open. I mean, I paged through your book, but I hadn't actually begun it yet. And so I'm reading the introduction. What do you say? I have often thought that hope is strengthened by remembering.
Remembering, yes.
Bada boom, bada bing. Right?
Yeah. It's so true. I heard that one time in a homily. And I didn't hear anything else of that homily. I just heard that. And it was just like, wow, that is true. I mean, that is so true. And it is so helpful when things look dark, when you look back and you see how many times God has been there for you, how many, someone recently said to me, today we are living the prayers of our past. And I thought, that is beautiful. That is true. I mean, we're living things that we prayed for,
right.
Anyway, yes, I love that. It puts everything in perspective, and it reminds you that nothing lasts. Not bad times, not even good times. Everything comes in its own good time. And yes, I love that quote. I'm glad you used it.
And in terms of the book, when you're looking at the female doctors of the church, all of whom are so incredible, what I loved about it is you brought it into the present day. What is so interesting, and I think we know this as Catholics, if we're at least somewhat remotely familiar with the saints, that many of the saints, or most of them, have gone through great suffering, right? Number one. And number two, they often, quite often, saw very similar, if not almost identical, struggles and situations, not only in the world, but in the church, similar to what we're experiencing today.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is what you continually return to in the book. So tell us what was going through your mind when you sat down to write this.
Well, the truth of the matter is, that kind of unfolded as I sat down to write it. I actually didn't know all that until I, started to do my research, and it was like, oh my goodness, these women are, my next door neighbor. I mean, I was thinking this morning before the interview, first of all, they all went through great physical suffering. And that I find, you know, very inspirational in the sense that they kept going. They gave it up. They offered it up. They lived through it. But of course that really built their character. I mean that, you know, going through things like that just make you stronger and your faith in God just stronger. But again, in addition to that, I mean, just obviously, one of the things that I didn't know before is the pre-scandals that each one of them had to endure. Mm-hmm. And each one of them tried to correct. I mean, I suppose that's the most obvious of when you read all four of them. It's just like, oh my goodness. And I mean, it just plays out in different ways. Like Teresa of Avila, I mean, even the head of the Carmelite order was like, please take over this order, you know, do something with it because I can't do anything with it. I mean, they were so disobedient to him and so living lives of, depravity, that type of thing. And it just follows through. I mean, St. Catherine of Siena, they just come through the pandemic, Black Death.
Yeah.
And so it's taken so many priests. And the ones who lived, and not just, you know, but they, you know, so few were left, and then they started accepting just anyone who could come to the seminary, you know, whether they were, you know, formed or not. And so that, you know, led to that whole, debacle, if you will. And St. Teresa of Lisieux, I just remember thinking with her when she was on that bus, or wherever, in Rome, and she was with those priests, and they were all like mingling with the rich and famous and drinking it up and, you know, hobnobbing and all this other kind of stuff. And that goes on today. I mean, it totally goes on today. And how, I mean, here's this little soul that is so devoted to God. She's going to beg the Pope.
Right.
To be allowed to enter the Carmelite, you know, monastery at such age 15 or something. And here she's just observing what's happening with the priest and observing what's happening with the church. But her way of helping was just prayer. I mean, just so much prayer. And then the same thing with Hildegard of Bingen. I mean, isn't she a trip?
She was incredible. What talent did she not have? I mean, you know, everything.
I know. Yeah. I thought to myself when I was writing, like, oh, this chapter's never going to end because she's everything.
Right.
But the same thing. I mean, she was allowed to, you know, go up and down the German countryside preaching, which was not something a woman in that age could do. But the priests were so, I think the word was effeminate. And it's not, that doesn't mean feminine. It just means effeminate, just like qualities of softness, I guess softness, that kind of thing, where they just couldn't stand up to the day. And so anyway, again, she goes off and she's preaching and doing her, speaking abroad and building her monastery and, you know, playing her music and having her visions.
Right.
And the whole thing. I mean, it was amazing.
It is amazing, and I think it's a message for all of us. And I also love what you weaved in there, that despite everything, despite what they saw, which, you know, if you read the book, it makes your toes curl, even in comparison to what we're seeing now, what they lived through, what they witnessed, and oftentimes persecution, especially if you're looking at St. Teresa of Avila and St. Catherine of Siena, direct persecution and attempts to silence them from church authority. But it gives me hope because they still recognized Christ in the church, and they still recognize the authority and respected it, but they also spoke out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. You know, one of the things that I found most interesting about Catherine of Siena is that when she died, she felt that she had died a failure. She thought all of her efforts were in vain.
Right.
And I just found that so interesting because she's one of the biggest saints in the church. Then here she dies just, she's not, you know, I mean, she's not apathetic or anything like that. Defeated, I think, would be a better word. And maybe not so much to the people around her, but to herself.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just rises like a phoenix. I mean, you know, and it's the same thing with Teresa of Lisieux. I mean, there were 30 people at her funeral. And when they dug her up, you know, to move her body, there was some like 3,000 or even more. I mean, her story had spread so far, so fast. And today she's just this great saint.
Right. Such examples of what we can do when we know our mission and when we keep turning to God for our mission. We're chatting with Terry Polakovic, the foundress and former president of A Beautiful Ministry in Dow, educating on the nature and dignity of women. And her latest book is Women of Hope, Doctors of the Church. I really recommend it, and especially for those of us who may be struggling and seeing what's happening in the church and the world. And the whole title, Women of Hope, we can never lose hope, which I think is the biggest point in the book.
Yes, we can't, no matter what. And again, God is always there. He's always there. And even in this time, I find this time very difficult. I really do. Every day, almost, you hear something or you read something, and I just have to look away. Honestly, I really just have to look away from it. But God is here. I mean, God is here in the faithful priest. We have a beautiful priest at our parish, and anyway, I mean, all the people who are, actually there's so many people returning to the church.
What really was powerful, it brought me to tears, was you had a very extensive quote of our Lord to St. Catherine in her dialogue regarding how do you handle the situation when you have the abuse crisis. She had it then, St. Teresa had it, you just reviewed all of that. But he had a warning, and he said we have to be very careful with that. Could you pick up on that point, if you would?
Well, I mean, I think you might be talking about him saying, these are my priests.
Right, exactly. Yes, that quote.
You do not ever criticize a priest. You never criticize a priest. These are my priests, and I will deal with them. That just hit me, because all we hear is criticism. I mean, it's so accepted today, and it's been accepted for many years now. I mean, many, you know, certainly McCarrick, but even, you know, the sex abuse crisis and all that kind of stuff. And so when I read that, it really startled me, actually. Like, no, you never do, no matter their mind. They give you me, you know. What more could you want? That type of thing. I can't, you know, obviously quote it
right.
Exactly, but that's the point of it, is that, you know, these men are in persona Christi. They give you me, you know, and also just the reminder that Christ saying, they're my priests, I'll deal with them. You know, you don't have to deal with them.
Right.
You know, that type of thing. And I thought that was powerful.
Oh, I think it's a powerful, and he's not saying that, you know, they're going to, if you read the whole quote, we don't have time to go through it all because it's quite extensive, but he's saying, and I think what he says, I will deal with them, he means his church will deal. That's my interpretation. He's not saying they're going to be allowed to continue you know, defame the office or to mistreat people or, God forbid, to engage in any type of illegal abusive activity, but he's saying to us that there is a way to handle it. And that it's not that we
right.
have to be like the mean girls and the mean boys and go on social media and attack and attack and attack and name call. That's not the way to handle it. The way to handle it is to, you know, do go to the church and especially let them know what's going on. There's a whole system that we have set up. That's one of the things that came out of the abuse crisis, and we're still working on it, that there is a way to really make sure that these complaints are handled. But I think that's just a reminder of what God is saying about the passing on of the faith when through the laying of hands and the importance of in persona Christi. Your thoughts?
I totally agree. I mean, I totally agree. And we do have a system, and we should not. I agree with you. I'm very tired of what's going on social media. We are not the boss. That's all there is to it. We have means to deal with this. We should do it and leave it. I mean, really, leave it. And trust God. I mean, trust God that it will be taken care of. I mean, I think that's my thought on that, is just that, like complete opposite of what's going on now. I mean, just complete opposite. It's, you know, people have made a life of talking about the priest and bishop. They are making a living, you know, off this, of defaming them on Catholic shows. You know, you think you're going to hell. I hate to tell you this, but you know what? You're going to go to hell for this. I mean, stop it. Save your soul.
Well, I think also keeping people in a constant state of negativity and angst about the situation, that is the oldest trick in the media book, okay? And it happens in secular media all the time. That's why, you know, if it bleeds, it leads is a famous saying in newsrooms, because we want to keep people in fear. Fear sells. And if you can keep people thinking that everything is horrible, they're going to tune back in because they want to make sure that they hear the latest about what's so terrible and horrible to make sure it doesn't affect them or to reaffirm some doubt or some hurt or some pain. And we're seeing this over and over again. And the saints were just as frustrated, were just as angry, were just as disgusted by what they saw. I mean, you just described that scene that you have in the book with St. Teresa of Avila. Or St. Teresa of Lisieux, and yet what did they do? They said, okay, I can only do so much. I can point this out. I can address it, as Catherine of Siena did in her letters and in her meetings, countless meetings and letters that she wrote and meetings she had with church leaders and politicians. But then they also did whatever else God called them to do. And they left it. They brought it up, and they left it. And then they kept praying, and then they kept witnessing.
Right. You couldn't have said it better. I mean, it's true. That's just their lives. They're beautiful lives. I mean, and I thought each one of them at their death, I mean, it was like they had come full circle. They had come, they were, I mean, I love that about Teresa of Avila, where she says, I die a daughter of
Oh, that, I was bawling on the plane. People thought I was nuts. They didn't know what's going on. I'm reading that. I'm like, oh, I love her so much.
I know, and I just feel the same way. And I want to die a daughter of the church.
Me too.
I just want to do whatever God asks of me, really. It's just a beautiful image. And, I loved it.
So what is your...
Catherine when she dies.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I know. Yeah, and that image of Catherine, that icon of her, the famous image of her, you know, holding the bark of the church on her shoulder. She just feels the weight of everything and you know, dying thinking that you know, she and herself failed, but yet, you know, she made such a difference. And I just think this is so important because the saints to me, I wrote a book about the saints a couple of years ago, Girlfriends and Other Saints, and I'm so glad that you're writing about the doctors of the church because we keep them on the shelves. We don't take them down enough and study their lives.
Right, exactly. I think we would be in such a different place, you know, if we paid attention to them. Even in homilies, if a priest gives the homily on the saint of the day and tells their story, it's very inspiring. I mean, it's so easy. It would be so easy if you were a priest just to look it up. And, you know, the people would be so well fed. Yes. In fact, it's so crazy because it's just crazy now. And I'm thinking, what saint... Send me another saint.
Yep.
You know, because I think we really, really have to look for the good of the church every day.
Yeah.
And it's right there. I mean, it's not like it's hidden.
No. But, study the saints. That's what I say. They're great. They're incredible teachers and witnesses for us. And they're cheering for us. They're interceding for us right now around the throne of God. Terry, great job on this. And I hope the book sells a gazillion copies because it's so important right now. They are women of hope, the four doctors of the church. We have, of course, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Catherine of Siena, St. Teresa of Lisieux, and St. Hildegard, amazing women of God who made a difference, who spoke up about the evils they saw, but then continued to do what they needed to do and what God was calling them to do. Keep up the great work, Terry. I know you're retired from one thing, but God's got work for you to do, sister. Great job on this book, Women of Hope, Doctors of the Church. We'll be right back.